Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loring. Coming up today, we're going to talk about climate change and what you can do to prepare for it. And later on, we'll talk about the effort to enact a national popular vote and try to get away from the Electoral College. And later on in the program, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll also hear some comments about yesterday's program later on in this program. But first up today, we're going to talk about how to prepare for climate change. Our guest is author David Pogue. He's the former host of 20 science specials for PBS's NOVA program, and he's now the technology and science correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. And he's written a new book about the world getting hotter and the dramatic and deadly weather events that are hitting us and how to prepare for it. The book is How to Prepare for Climate Change. I spoke with David Pogue yesterday as he was sitting in his house outside of New York City and getting hit by a giant snowstorm. David Pogue, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
All right, so let me just ask you, you're in the middle of a blizzard, maybe a record blizzard for this year or maybe the past few years. And you're writing a book about You're writing a book about climate change. Tell us what it looks like outside your window, and how do you convince somebody? How do you tell somebody that climate change is really happening as you're sitting there in the blizzard?
Yeah, out my window, I can almost not even see anything. It's so white. I mean, they blanket white with snow. I mean, I think science does itself a real disservice by using the term global warming. It's, I mean, as you've already implied, it's really misleading. It makes people think that the problem is the Earth warming. And yeah, that's basically the underlying start of everything. But the results of it are all kinds of nutty systemic breakdowns of weather. So, you know, climate change means freak heat waves and freak snowstorms. It means droughts and intense rains. It means, you know, unbelievable flooding and water shortages. All of that is new. I've heard people say climate chaos, and I think that's probably a better term, because it just means the upsetting of normal systems, not necessarily related to warmth.
So we've seen a lot of examples where we've got this increased number of hurricanes down here in Florida and throughout the Southeast, and we've seen the terrible wildfires on the West Coast. We've seen flooding in unusual areas. Is there a map that predicts where in the U.S. there will be less climate chaos? Is anybody tracking that to say, okay, we predict that such and such areas will suffer the least under climate chaos?
Aha! You have seen chapter two of my book. Yeah, exactly. That's actually the number one question that I get about the book is where should I move if I have that opportunity? You know, if I'm retiring or getting out of school or am weighing two different jobs. I mean, the basic answer is, yeah, you want to be far enough east so that you're away from the wildfires, far enough west so that you're away from the coast, you know, sea level rise and hurricanes, far enough from the, you know, from the Gulf Coast so you avoid the hurricanes. And, you know, in general, you want to avoid the heat waves of the South. And so basically the ideal spot for the coming decades is the Midwest, the Great Lakes. And not only do they not have hurricanes or sea level rise or wildfires, but they also have an unlimited amount of fresh water. And drinking water is becoming a real problem in many parts of the country. I mean, the western half of the country has been in more or less perpetual drought. California and Oregon, they've been in drought for like 8 years now, and it's only going to get worse. So the beauty of that sweet spot, the Midwest, is that they've got the Great Lakes. So they should be set for a long time.
So Buffalo and Chicago and Cleveland and the upper Midwest, maybe even Toronto and Canada, here we come.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this new concept people talk about, climate refugees. And right now they're mostly coming from, well, Florida and California and maybe some Louisiana. So these are people who say, I've had enough of having my house knocked down from these extreme weather events. I'm moving. And so those are kind of sweet spots. And by the way, those cities aren't just good climate havens, there are other considerations for where you want to settle. Like, is it a low cost of living? Are there jobs? What's the culture like? Do they have sports teams? Are there good hospitals? That's going to be increasingly important. So, yeah, so some of those old rust belt cities are poised to have sort of a renaissance as new havens for climate refugees.
It's interesting you say that, because we still get the numbers down here in Florida. 1,000 new people move to Florida every day. And I can tell you, just driving on the roads, I see license plates from all over the country and parts of Canada. And I even see those license plates in the summertime as people move here from Minneapolis and Texas and Illinois and New York.
Yeah. Well, of course, what you can't tell by the license plates is how many people aren't there anymore, you know, like how much the tide is also running the other direction, because that's invisible to you. There was a study by this guy, Lawrence Smith, I interviewed him for the book, on, you know, by 2050, so, you know, 30 years from now, which states will have exhibited the greatest population gain and population loss as a result of the new climate chaos. And it probably won't surprise you to hear that Florida was the number one biggest population loser as the coast. I mean, when people hear that, you know, Florida might see a foot of sea level rise by, you know, 2050, they're like, a foot, you know, who cares about a foot? Well, the thing is, every foot upward that the water goes, that's 300 to 500 feet inward. You know, that's businesses and streets and basements and homes. So eventually, but especially Miami is the real problem, as I'm sure your listeners all know. Eventually, some of these shoreline communities are just going to have to give up and leave. So yeah, Florida is projected to be the biggest population loser, and Texas, interestingly, is supposed to be the number one gainer. And the theory is that's because most people, when they move only within driving distance, you know, four hours. So all the people from Louisiana, you know, Western Florida might just go to Texas and call it a day, but not on the coast.
David Pogue is best-selling author and the CBS Sunday Morning Science and Technology correspondent. He's got a new book out called How to Prepare for Climate Change. And we're listening to David right now on 88.5 FM. So, David, is there any turn back? Is there any turning back? Have we reached a tipping point? Can I go out tomorrow and buy an electric car and say, okay, I've done my part, and, you know, if all my neighbors buy an electric car, we're going to turn this thing around?
Oh, man, I wish. No, the weather and the earthly conditions of, you know, let's say the 80s are gone. They are gone. So we will not see that. A return to that in our lifetimes or our children's lifetimes, even if we start doing the right thing immediately, which is, you know, stop burning fossil fuels and don't fly so much, don't eat so much red meat. What we can do, though, is we can make the outcome less disastrous. In other words, you know, the UN does this massive survey every few years of where are we and how bad is it going to be, and they project what it'll be like in 2050 and 2100. And they have a couple of scenarios. I mean, there's like a truly hell on earth scenario where the sea level rises 9 feet and the coasts are underwater and hundreds of millions of people have to leave and flee because they can't grow anything because the farmland is underwater, you know, that kind of thing. And then there's a more modest scenario. And I have to say right now, it's really looking like the pendulum has swung toward the modest scenario. I mean, yes, in the last 4 years, you know, the federal government of the U.S. didn't do anything about climate change and, you know, of course, scrubbed the words climate change from all the government websites. But in the meantime, even without the government, so many governments and industries and corporations and states, 25 states, in fact, said we are still in the Paris Agreement. Like, we're going to stick to those goals even without the government. And now, of course, we have elected a president. I don't know, you know, I don't care about what your politics are, but this president has said that climate change is, you know, among his top two or three priorities, and he's making big, big strides. So I do think that the great decarbonization of our society, you know, weaning ourselves away from coal, oil, and gas is really well underway. So I'm optimistic that we're going to stave off the worst of it, but But yeah, what we're seeing now, the hurricanes, the wildfires, and so on, that's here to stay.
So what you're talking about, at least in terms of that, is kind of a new normal that, you know, if you thought, well, maybe California solved its wildfire problem, no, it hasn't solved it. And if you think about Miami Beach as, you know, the water's getting higher and higher surrounding Miami Beach, it's really not going to stop for the foreseeable future. So,
no, it's really not. In fact, for a CBS Sunday Morning Story, I interviewed a fire chief of Cal Fire. That's the California department who's in charge of all the wildfires and forestry management. And I asked him, are you glad now that this worst fire season in recorded history is over? And he said, oh, no. Like, internally, we're like, okay, that's the baseline. It gets worse from here. Mm. I mean, they're expecting those wildfires to be 6 times worse by 2050. So, yeah, new normal is absolutely the way to think of it.
All right. For those of us who can't move, who can't afford to move, is there a way to harden our buildings? I mean, obviously, you can't live on the coastline and expect not to feel some, here in Florida, not to feel some sort of repercussions from the rising sea levels. But if you're inland, is there something you can do to kind of protect against the most serious consequences of climate chaos?
Boy, do I have a book to recommend to you. Yes. That is, in fact, what the 620 pages of this How to Prepare for Climate Change book are all about. And even if you are on the coast, even if you do have a waterfront property, there are things you can do. I mean, the things you can do now to prepare for disasters that you pretty much know are coming. I mean, it's essentially inevitable that sooner or later you're going to get hit, especially if you're a Florida resident. Include everything from looking into your insurance situation. I know it sounds incredibly boring and wonky, but the fact is that only 18% of Americans who live in the flood zones have flood insurance, which is incredible to me. Most people don't realize that homeowners insurance does not include coverage for flooding. Even if you have regular insurance, you're not covered for flood damage. So there's that. And then there's all kinds of things you can do to your home itself, ranging from there are various companies that will sell you these vertical aluminum beams that when a hurricane is coming, you can snap against your garage doors and protect them. It turns out that the garage is the biggest weakness of your home, these huge, very weak, segmented wooden panels that in a hurricane, the wind just blows in there, blows them out, and builds up the air pressure inside your home, like blows up like a balloon. And that's where you see those roofs blown up. So you can actually stabilize the garage doors either with one of those commercial things or a pinch. You can even take a 2x4, stack it vertically against the inside of the garage door, and gently back your car up against it and prop it in place. And even that will make your garage doors a lot stronger in the case of a hurricane. And then in extreme situations, there are even people who are sacrificing their ground floor to weather, to climate change. You know, they make the second floor the new ground floor, and they make the first floor sort of their garage and storage area underneath the house. So when the flooding comes, it just floods through and they don't really care.
Well, we're talking about the new book, How to Prepare for Climate Change, with its author, David Pogue, and this is WMNF in Tampa. David, let me just zigzag for a moment and just bring up something that we talked about earlier, how far we've gone in this direction. And that is that in your book, you say 93% of our new improved heat, this heat that's heating up the planet, has gone into the oceans. Into the oceans. So what does that mean?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why we won't be able to turn the climate crisis around in 5 years or 20 years. It's because the ocean has absorbed most of the Earth's new heat, and the ocean takes a long time to cool up or to cool down or warm up. So it's a freighter that you can't turn around on a dime. So the more heat that's stored in the oceans, that's like this big reservoir of heat that takes, you know, a lifetime to cool down. And, you know, there's, of course, also these reinforcing vicious cycles. It used to be that a lot of the Earth's surface was covered by ice, you know, Greenland and Antarctica and so on. And the ice is white, and that reflects the sun's heat back out into space. And that has kept the Earth at a climate, you know, temperate climate for many generations. As that ice melts, it means two things. One is it melts into the oceans, which makes the ocean sea level rise, and it gets rid of the white, and even an iceberg's melting, that turns white areas of ice into black areas of ocean, which absorbs heat from the sun, just like a black sweater in the summer makes you hotter. So we do have, unfortunately, these cycles that make them continue to heat up.
You talk about places like Phoenix, Arizona. I mean, you suggested that people go to Texas, and the Texas Real Estate Development Commission thanks you for that mention. But you talk about Phoenix, Arizona, and the number of days over 100 degrees. And Phoenix is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. You know, I've been in South Texas in the summer, and that's a brutal heat. What's your prediction about the future of Phoenix, given so many days over 100 degrees there?
I mean, there's no question. If there's population growth now, that's going to reverse itself. I mean, there's no question. It is just unlivably hot. I mean, people have oven mitts in their glove compartments just because when they get into the car, it's too hot to touch the steering wheel. There were, as the headlines made clear in the last couple summers, there were days when planes couldn't take off from the Phoenix airport because the air is so hot, it's thin. So thin that the planes can't get lift from their wings, but they had to ground flights. The zoo now opens at like 5 in the morning and then closes during the middle of the day so that both people and animals can stay out of the heat. And in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is much cooler, it's altitude 7,000 feet, there are so many people trying to move to Flagstaff out of Phoenix that the Flagstaff people joke about they should build a wall to keep out the Phoenix people. So, yeah, Phoenix is sort of a canary in the coal mine about what the hotter states are going to be like in the coming years. I mean, it is brutal there now.
As you look at our country and how we're preparing for it and hardening our cities and making sure that roads aren't flooded during high tide, as we're preparing in the U.S., how would you compare what our level of consciousness in government versus the level of consciousness in other countries' governments? Are we preparing as fast as countries in Europe are or as fast as countries in Asia are for this climate chaos?
I mean, the answer would have been very different a month ago, of course. We, as the United States, have been lagging way behind on climate awareness and climate adaptation, which means, getting ready. From other countries. But all over the world, there are these enormous, I got to say, really cool public works projects, like the biggest things ever built, enormous $50 billion seawalls around, the southern tip of Manhattan they're talking about. There's even a proposal for Miami. And they're well underway in Chicago, London, Tokyo, Jakarta, Indonesia, these vast underground tunnels and caverns meant to hold trillions of gallons of runoff water when the flooding comes. In London, they call it the super sewer. These like absolutely gigantic tunnels that are meant to hold the Thames River water when it overflows. So most countries around the world. And China, of course. China has severe climate change issues. So much flooding, and they also are doing these enormous public works projects. A lot of cities, including Chicago, and many of these 600 cities in China, are working on making their cities deliberately floodable. In other words, they say, yeah, the floodwaters are going to come, but then they're going to recede. So what can we do to make ourselves more resilient? New York City is working on this too. So it involves making your coastal parks filled with, berms, like raised earthen walls to sort of keep the seawater out, planting them with mangroves and other really thirsty trees and plants that we associate with swampland, and making the streets out of permeable pavement. That is like pavement that water can seep down into, so that instead of flooding the roads, the water can drain away. There's some really cool ideas underway.
You know, I think the politics of this is, if I could zigzag into that topic for just a second, and that is people that resist preparing for climate change here in the U.S. say it's going to destroy jobs, all those fracking jobs, all those coal mining jobs. You're not going to see people building new power plants using natural gas. And so the number of jobs in the U.S. is just going to disappear and wither away because we've decided that we want to have clean energy if we go in this direction of trying to protect the planet. When you hear that talk about jobs disappearing, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it's a reasonable concern. I did a radio interview much like this one yesterday with a Louisiana radio station, and they said, they opened the interview by saying, can you believe that General Motors just announced that they are going to become an all-electric car company? What do you think, Pogue? And I said, well, it's truly amazing. I mean, they're a big corporate calcified behemoth corporation, and they're deciding to do the right thing for the world. I think that's fantastic. And he said, you do realize that many of our listeners work in the petroleum industry here in Louisiana.
Yeah.
I'm like, I shouldn't have opened my mouth. But the premise that switching to clean energy is going to involve losing jobs is not at all established. Like, already it is documentably true that the solar industry employs more people than the coal industry. I mean, who would believe that? All that talk of saving the coal miners' jobs? Well, no. If they can be retrained, if they can be incorporated into the new gold rush of clean energy, there's more jobs available to come than we have now. So as you've hinted, there are zero new coal plants planned for construction in the United States. I mean, I interviewed 55 experts for this climate book, and the energy guys said coal is dead in the United States. There is going to be no more coal capacity added. Meanwhile, 72% of the new electricity generation added in the United States last year was solar and wind. I mean, that is where the money is. That is where the jobs are. It's a huge new infrastructure we're going to have to build to get rid of carbon from our cycle. And that means jobs. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs and so much money being spent. So, I mean, nobody knows for sure whether, you know, who will be the winners and the losers. But to say it's a net loss of jobs, I don't think that's necessarily a proven fact.
All right. So is there much return? I joked about an electric car. I do have a hybrid and I love it. But I joked about going out and buying an electric car. If we do the things in our homes, like replace all the lights with LED lights, replace the old incandescent bulbs with LEDs, and we have a rain barrel attached to our house, and we strengthen our house to make sure that it's updated to hurricane standards, put more insulation in the roof, and we're not using as much energy during the day. I mean, can we as individuals do anything to impact the future of the planet?
That's a great question. I mean, there's a whole chapter in the book about this issue. Is like, really, when 100 corporations on the planet Earth are responsible for 71% of the carbon emissions, really change your light bulbs and you're going to make a difference? So the answer is no. You are not going to create a big percentage difference by changing your light bulbs. However, there are two reasons individuals should still embrace trying to reduce their carbon footprint. The first one is that, of course, cumulatively, it will make a difference. If, you know, 30% of us started driving electric cars instead of burning gas in our cars, that would move the needle. If 50% of us started eating less red meat, less beef, that would move the needle. Because this I didn't know until I worked on the book. Incredibly, one-third of all land on the planet is dedicated to cattle grazing. Can you believe that? One-third. And they are greenhouse gas machines. I mean, one cow belches out 12 gallons of methane an hour. And methane, in case you're keeping score at home, is about 80 times worse as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So, yeah, so if we could persuade people to eat less red meat, that would make a huge difference because agriculture is one of the big things. But the second really big component to this is this social contagion idea. And one of the psychologists I spoke to said, look, if we go out for lunch, four of us, and three of us order the salad, are you really going to order the double cheeseburger? You're going to feel a social pressure to do the right thing. It's the same way that, you know, there are fewer smokers now because there's that shaming that happens when they have to stand outside the building to get a smoke break. Sooner or later, if enough people put solar panels on their homes in your neighborhood, you are provably more likely to put one up on your roof. So it's called social contagion or the social norms effect, where if everybody else starts behaving one way, you will behave that way too. So that's the other thing, is if everybody made a lot of these small changes, they would add up to huge changes.
David, one last question. Do you fear that the kids may not know what we're losing? Like if we have young kids at home, and you and I grew up in an era where summers were summers and winters were winters, and there was a lot of snow that in northern climates in the upper Midwest and New York that lasted from November through early March, and that was the way it was. Some winters now in the Northeast and the North, there's hardly any snow. I'm just wondering if kids view the world today as kind of the new normal. Yeah, there's going to be 15 or 20 hurricanes every year, and some are going to really, you know, tear through Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana and Florida. And they're going to view that as normal and kind of reach a point of acceptance.
I think that's probably right. I think that, you know, you grow up accepting what is as what is. As you say, the Northeast weather is changing. When I was growing up, we talked about the beautiful colors in the fall. And one effect of the climate chaos is that the fall foliage is not as bright and colorful anymore. And the season is shorter. And so people will hear their grandparents or their parents talk about, well, when I was growing up, we didn't get these. But that will mean as little to our children as, you know, it does to us hearing our grandparents talk about, you know, the war or whatever. Yeah, Gramps. Yeah, it was tough. I get it. So you're absolutely right. I mean, you learn the world as it is as you're growing up, and that's what's happening now.
What do you say to kids, though? What's that conversation you should have with your kids about what's going on?
Yeah, there's actually a chapter in the book about this, too. That's how to talk to your kids. I've got three kids, and my instinct would be to try to shield them from the worst of it. I mean, why bring up, you know, the hurricanes or the wildfires that killed people and wiped out towns? Why upset them for no reason? And I interviewed five child psychologists for that chapter, and they all told me I'm dead wrong, that is not the approach. That children need to know, if you sugarcoat things and then they learn from the news or the internet or school or their friends what's really going on, then not only do they no longer trust you, but they wonder why you were sugarcoating things. They think it must be really terrible if it drove you to minimize the truth. So, you know, there are ways to talk to your kids of each age group, but the general idea is you shouldn't minimize it. You should explain how the climate is changing and why it's changing. And then you explain that the world's best scientists are working on the problem and that there are we as a family can do to help with the problem. Let's start doing that now. Let's carpool. Let's take the bus or the subway into town instead of driving. Let's ride our bikes tomorrow. I mean, you start teaching them things that will help with the problem in the long run. And that way it's, you know, taking action is always an antidote to depression. Like making it feel like you have some control over a bad situation always makes it feel better. And that's why helping your kids to understand, to take action helps them. And that's really, in a way, what this entire book is about. It's addressing your own despair by taking action to take some control over a bad situation.
It's always good advice. David, before I let you go, is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about this or anything you've learned since you've written the book that you'd like to tell our audience?
You know, Barack Obama had a chief science advisor named John Holdren, and he famously said in to the New York Times a few years ago, there are really three ways we can react to the changing climate. There's mitigation, which means trying to stop the climate from changing. There's adaptation, which is trying to adapt to it and make the effects not so bad. And there's suffering. And how much we do of the first two affects how much we do of the third one. And so I think my approach in doing this entire project was everything we read, I mean everything we read, is about mitigation. Fly less, drive less, eat less red meat. And that's all really important. We need to do that. Absolutely nothing I could find had been written for the individual about the second part of that formula, about adapting. And I just think it's time. It's no longer in question that things are changing, that the weather is getting more dangerous. Why not take a Saturday afternoon, cost almost nothing, and get yourself ready for the worst?
The book is How to Prepare for Climate Change, and the author is David Pogue, who is the CBS Sunday Morning Science and Technology correspondent. David, thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Well, that was an interview I did with David yesterday. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and this is Radioactivity. Well, because of the Electoral College and the winner-take-all statutes in most states, five of our 45 presidents have come into office without having won the most popular votes nationwide. The 2000 and 2016 elections are the most recent examples of elections in which a second-place candidate won the White House. There is a movement to elect presidents by the popular vote, and we're going to talk with a spokesperson for that movement right now. He is Pat Rosensteel, who is a senior consultant with National Popular Vote, and he joins us live right now. Patrick, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me. Grateful.
All right. So what is the National Popular Vote? What is that movement about?
Well, it's about it's a movement that's going through the states that is 100% committed to electing the president by national popular vote. We use the power in the U.S. Constitution that allows states to determine how they're going to award electors. And when we have states with 270 or more electoral votes in place, all of those states will agree to award in bloc their electors to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in all 50 states. In the District of Columbia, and that will deliver a national popular vote for president.
And this is called the National Popular Vote Compact. How many states have signed on so far?
Yeah, so far we've got 16 states who have our bill as their law. Those 16 states have 196 electoral votes, so we only need 74 more electoral votes before the 2024 presidential election to have a national popular vote for president. And, you know, we just think every voter in every state should be politically relevant in every presidential election. The current system is a disaster and it's getting dangerous. You know, we believe we should elect the president of the United States, not the battleground states, and believe that if we do so, people will get better at living with the results, you know, and that's our mission.
Does this do away with the Electoral College?
Well, no, it doesn't need to. I mean, that's a misconception, right? I think there's way too much focus on the Electoral College when what we should be focused on is having a national popular vote for president. And the U.S. Constitution allows states to award electors in any manner they deem is in the best interest of the country and their voters. And we just believe a vast majority of the states, it's better for their voters. It's certainly better for the country. If we had enough electors to guarantee the presidency to the candidate who wins the national popular vote. So, you know, we don't eliminate the Electoral College because it's not necessary to do that to have a national popular vote for president. And we're focused on the plan that can get done, which is the plan at nationalpopularvote.com.
What's the status in Florida? Have you attempted this in Florida?
Bill introduced this legislative session. We've got great coalition partners down there that are leading the effort. I would say down in Florida, you want to get in touch with the League of Women Voters, who have been working with the sponsors in the Senate. They've been informing the media and opinion makers and grassroots activists. And, you know, so there is a bill that's been introduced in the Florida legislature. And, you know, I think if everybody wants a national popular vote for president, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Conservative, Liberal, or Moderate down there in Florida, called their legislator and asked them to support the national popular vote bill, that would be a good thing. It would be timely. and we'd appreciate their shoulder to the wheel.
All right, so talk about some of the states. Where have you won this victory already, where the state legislature passes the national popular vote bill?
Yeah, we've passed in 16 states, and, you know, I could rattle them all off, but that'd be burning time. But we've passed in small states like, Vermont, Rhode Island, big states like California, New York, and medium-sized states like Maryland, you know. So we've passed in 16 states, and what's interesting, we've done that in a bipartisan way, right? This isn't a Democrat or a Republican idea. I happen to be a Republican, and have been my whole life. A full-throated proponent of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. But what's important to point out is we've passed one chamber or another in 9 additional states with 88 electoral votes, right? More than the 74 required. And those are states like, you know, Arizona, where we passed the House of Representatives that was Republican-controlled. And in Oklahoma, we passed the Senate but have not yet passed the House, so we still have some work to do. We passed the House of Representatives in Virginia and still have a little bit of work to do in the Senate. But, I think when I started it with this effort in 2007, I was like, this is going to be neat if it happens. Now it's a matter of when is this going to happen. And I certainly hope it's in place for the 2024 presidential election, because the current system is an absolute disaster. Nobody wins with it. The truth is it leads to situations where we have to board up major cities before we have a presidential election, because one side fears the other side's going to win. And then after the election, we've got to put the National Guard in front of the Capitol, because one side's not, well, I don't even want to say one side, but, radical elements are, taking over the Congress. At the end of the day, what we need to do is we need to have a system of electing the president where every American voter, no matter what state or precinct they live in, feels valued in the presidential election. We need to end this system where the only people who matter are battleground state voters that force us to think about whether we're a red state or a blue state. Let's just elect an American president where every voter is politically valued. And I think we'll all get better at living with the results. If my team loses, I'll just get organized to try to win the next one.
How do you think it would de-radicalize the country? I mean, if people are fearful of the current system and they have to identify as red state or blue state, how would this de-radicalize or calm things down?
Well, I think what happens in presidential elections right now, so for example, just this last presidential election, 96% of the campaign occurred in just 12 states, right? 38 states were almost wholly ignored as the candidates campaigned in the general election campaign. And so you have this mentality of red states, blue states, and battleground states. And I think it leads to tribalism, right? Under a national popular vote system, there are no red states or blue states. There are no battleground states. There's every American voter casting their ballot for president. They're going to be valued in that process. Like my vote as a Republican in Minnesota is going to matter every bit as much as a Democrat would, for example, in Oklahoma City. And I just think at the end of the day, what we need voters to understand that they're valued in the process, that we're electing an American president, that, our candidates are going to win or lose sometimes, right? But there's a lot that brings us together. And I just think it'll end the tribalism, because we'll be done looking at whether we're red on the map or blue on the map. I think, this system, more than any other thing in American politics, divides us into red states and blue states. And I think it's time for it to go away. The truth is we're not stuck with it. Anybody who thinks the current system is working, they might turn on your radio program or they might turn on the TV, right? So, where the state of American politics is today, systemic reform matters. The most important systemic reform we can pursue is changing the way we elect the president of the United States. 16 states have taken us up on that offer. We need more to join the effort. We need anybody who wants one person, one vote in presidential elections to call their legislator, and we need to get this done.
Our guest is Patrick Rosensteel, who's a senior consultant with the National Popular Vote. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact will, they say, guarantee the presidency to the candidate who receives the most popular votes across all 50 states and the District of Columbia. For the last number of years, Florida's been one of the battleground states. What's it like to live in a place like California, which is a strong blue state, or Texas up until recently. What's it like to live in those states during a presidential election? Are those states essentially ignored?
Well, yeah, it's just like living in a small state like North Dakota or Vermont, totally ignored, right? So are the large states because they're reliably Republican or reliably Democrat. We know that under the state-based winner-take-all law, California's 55 electoral votes are going to go to the Democrat before we know who the candidate is. We know that the three electoral votes in North Dakota are going to go to the Republican, right? And what is it like? I mean, we know what the result is when you're ignored in presidential elections. The U.S. Election Assisting Commission, for example, turnout in battleground states like Florida, 11 points higher than flyover states in 2016. In 2012, it was 16 points higher, right? So participation rates plummet, right? When participation rates plummet because you don't feel valued in the system, right, you get this entrenched political ideology at some level that this system isn't working for you.
Does that happen?
So at the end of the day... Yeah,
does that have an effect on the down ballot candidates then in places where turnout's?
Yeah. Flyover states are exporters of political economy too, right? So they export all of their campaign contributions to the brand standard race, that is the presidential campaign. Those go to the national campaign and then get redistributed in a handful of battleground states. And I'll just say, you know, Florida is definitely a battleground state, but. You know, it's not great shakes being a battleground state either because foreign elements in their trade policies, when they retaliate on tariffs, for example, trying to do damage on an American president, they target Florida industries, right? Not flyover state industries. So, you know, at the end of the day, this isn't about making Florida irrelevant. It's about making every American voter relevant. It's about saying, you know, if you're an American citizen, you should be valued, your participation should be valued in presidential campaigns. Your president should govern to the interests of the voters in all 50 states, you know, not just narrow special interests in the battleground states, right? And so at the end of the day, you change the system, you change the incentives to campaign and govern, and it doesn't matter if you live in North Dakota or California, Boca Raton or Bismarck, you know what I mean? You're an American voter, and you're going to be valued in the process. And American pluralism can work, you know, and it's seriously, it's the most important systemic reform in my lifetime, in my adult lifetime. You know, voting rights acts, those kinds of things were fairly important too. But this is incredibly important, and I think the future of our republic sort of depends on it.
All without the heavy lift of doing away with the Electoral College.
Well, and it's not even about the heavy lift; it's just not necessary. Right. So at the end of the day, you can move to a national popular vote for president. You can do it by 2024 by getting behind the national popular vote interstate compact. And the reason you can do it is because the United States Constitution allows it, leaves it to the legislature to award electors. I always like to say, I don't change the Tampa City Charter to fill a pothole, right? You guys don't get potholes like I do in Minnesota, but
no, we get them too.
I don't have to change the city charter to fill a pothole because the power exists to fill the pothole. You know, the power exists to move to a national popular vote for president. If you are an advocate for a national popular vote for president, pretty simple yes or no question. You know, if you are, call your legislator, tell them to support the national popular vote interstate compact. If you are not a proponent of the national popular vote, you know, then own the current system. But I can't think of a single defensible quality to the current system. And anybody who can, I think, is not paying attention.
Patrick, if people want to get involved, how can they do that?
Yeah, best way to do it is nationalpopularvote.com. There are three things you can do there. One is write your legislator. You can put in your, you know, zip code. And it pops up, and you can weigh in with your legislator. We can find that person for you. The second thing you can do is obviously click the volunteer button. We like to get people involved in all 50 states. And then the third thing you can do, of course, is you can contribute whatever you could there to support our efforts to get this done. And with your help, we will. That's a guarantee.
Patrick Rosenstiel, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Grateful for the time. Appreciate your interest.
Thanks, Patrick. Bye-bye. And Pat Rosenstiel, senior consultant, National Popular Vote. You can find him at nationalpopularvote.com. com. And if you want to comment about anything we've talked about so far, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. At the top of the show, I didn't play comments about yesterday's show, so let's go to those comments right now. And then we're going to open up the phone lines live and take your phone calls at 813-239-9663. Yesterday, we ended up talking a lot about Publix controversy. So here's several listener comments that came in after yesterday's program.
Yeah. Hi. Yesterday, during your pre-recorded segment, you interviewed the head of the Hillsborough County Republican Party, and he spouted off some provable lies, just absolutely factually incorrect QAnon lies about who was responsible for the Capitol insurgency that was a seditious act of treason against the United States. It's clear from records, online communications, video, photos, and the confessions of the insurgents themselves that, contrary to what this Republican guy said, it wasn't Antifa or some left-wing group pretending to be Trumpers who did that terrible thing. It was the Trump cult, and they openly said they were going to do it, and the president definitely incited them using coded language and stochastic terrorism. So please, Republicans, stop lying to yourselves and to all the rest of us. The facts are not on your side.
Jim from Port Richey, I heard that about Publix, and I think what's going to happen with what they will do to the rest of us that shop there is raise the prices even more. They're already so sky high, but I follow the sales. You walk by the beef, no matter what the price is, they know you're going to pay it eventually when you get a taste for beef. They don't care about high prices. We do, but I think this is what they'll use for retaliation against us that shop there.
Hey there, this is Karen in Dunedin. I did not shop at Publix yesterday for the bulk of my groceries, but I did end up having to go there to get one item. I could find no other place. In my book, you're indirectly supporting Trump and DeSantis by shopping there, so I will be shopping elsewhere.
Hello, this is Kevin. Want to leave a message about today's radio activity show, and I just thought that I'd mention, knowing what we do now about the Jenkins fortune being used to help fund the insurrection, when it comes to having to choose where to shop, it's a very, very sad day when we have a choice between the two most popular supermarkets, one supporting the insurrection, the other supporting low-wage workers. And it really is sad that we don't have more choices.
That got cut off. That was those were listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. Yesterday, part of the conversation was about the Publix heiress who had spent $300,000 giving most of the money that it took to run the protest that was outside the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, the protest that led to the march, that led to the insurrection. And it was a Publix heir who funded most of that protest rally that took place where President Trump and Rudy Giuliani spoke. Well, if you want to comment about any of these topics, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Every line is open. We have a bunch of emails that have come in. I'll read some of those. James writes, James in St. Pete says, I had a conversation about 10 years ago with a climate denier who didn't believe in global warming or climate change or anything like that. But there was one thing that I was able to get him to agree with me on. We have to stop polluting, writes James. Yeah, and carbon dioxide is pollution. David writes this, I saw your guest, David Pogue, on TV recently and found it fascinating that the Great Lakes are the place to be. I've always lived in Florida and would find it hard to get accustomed to the cold weather up there, writes David. And then Jeff writes this, I appreciate getting an idea of what we can do to react to climate change. My biggest question is, what is the most realistic replacement for fossil fuels? Can solar and wind provide enough energy to power the planet? Is nuclear still a consideration? Are there any other possible energy sources? Writes Jeff. And Jeff, since I'm not a scientist, I'm not going to answer that. But I think there are answers to that question, and I will do future programs about it. Thank you for that. Charles in Tampa writes, a great interview with David Pogue. Thank you for that. And thank you, Charles, for listening to the interview. And then Ernie writes this, I'd like you to do an impartial examination of why the Electoral College was founded. That's Ernie in Port Richey. We're going to talk or touch on the topic of the Electoral College again tomorrow with my guest tomorrow. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Ray Ann in Seminole, Florida. Hi, Ray Ann. How are you?
Ernie writes this. I'd like you to do an impartial.
Ray Ann, you got to. We're going to ask you to listen to your phone and not your radio. So, Ray Ann, if you're there right now listening to your phone, we'll put you on live. Let's try it one more time. Ray Ann, are you there? Hi,
Hello?
Ray Ann. Hi, Ray Ann. You're on MNF.
This is Mary Ann.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mary Ann.
Sorry, I wasn't connecting. Okay.
Sorry about
Rob,
that.
I just want quickly to write down the website or whatever, the email of the person you interviewed just before. I missed it.
Pat Rosensteel with the National Popular Vote?
Yes.
All right. That's nationalpopularvote.com.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's all I needed. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. And let's go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Hi, Nancy. You're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hi. I just think that was a wonderful idea of what your guest suggested. I just think that's terrific. I'm going to look it up. And thank you so much for having these wonderful speakers on. I'm just so impressed. I can't believe it. The little old us has all this terrific stuff. Thank you. You know,
okay.
Usually you find this kind of interviews and everything and really great, you know, good websites and magazines. But this is terrific. And just keep up the good work, Rob. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Nancy. That's nice of you to say. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Oh, it's just the fact, man.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
So just the National Popular Vote bill, and we heard our guest talk about earlier, has already been enacted by 16 jurisdictions. And it tells electors from the state that go to Washington, D.C., as members of the Electoral College, you must represent the National Popular Vote when you go there. So you're not going to represent the state of Florida anymore. You're going to just say, my votes go to the person who won the national popular vote. And already several states, Delaware, Hawaii, Rhode Island, Vermont, eight medium-sized states, Colorado, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington, and three big states, California, Illinois, and New York, they've all signed on to the national popular vote. They've got 196 electoral college votes so far. They just need 74, and there is a bill in Tallahassee. Terry writes this, and by the way, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Terry writes this, I'm not in favor of a food store boycott. It only hurts the lower-level essential workers. The owners are not going to take less profits, writes Terry, who's out there in cyberspace. You know, I've heard the position made that people are going to write letters to the Publix management and say that they're going to not shop there every week. Like they do now for those who do. But they're going to shop there every 3 weeks, and the fourth week they're going to go somewhere else until Publix shows some good faith and expression that it's not going to just simply fund right-wing causes. And of course, the woman who funded the protest at the Capitol is not a current employee of Publix. She's an heiress and heir to a large fortune. But the Publix Corporation has given money to very conservative causes over the years. So, Yeah, but Terry, thank you. Thank you for making the point. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play those comments back that you record today, tomorrow at 11 o'clock. And this is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. Barbara Fling has been our phone producer today. Your hero, Mark Bureau, is coming up in the next hour, so stick around for him. And it is Groundhog Day, so we're expecting that call from Mike. This is WMNF in Tampa.